turn off the power, and go off to other things, neglecting to save any of your work. Or you get into your car on Sunday and go to the store and find yourself at the office. The capture error appears whenever two different action sequences have their initial stages in common, with one sequence being unfamiliar and the other being well-practiced. Seldom, if ever, does the unfamiliar sequence capture the familiar one. Description errors. A former student reported that one day he came home from jogging, took off his sweaty shirt and rolled it up in a ball, intending to throw it in the laundry basket. Instead, he threw it in the toilet. It wasn't poor aim. The laundry basket and toilet were in different rooms. In the common slip known as the description error, the intended action has much in common with others that are possible. As a result, unless the action sequence is completely and precisely specified, the intended action might fit several possibilities. Suppose that my tired student in the example formed a mental description of his intended action, something like, throw the shirt into the opening at the top of the container. This description would be perfectly unambiguous and sufficient were the laundry basket the only open container in sight. But when the open toilet was visible, its characteristics matched the description and triggered the inappropriate action. This is a description error, because the internal description of the intention was not sufficiently precise. Description errors usually result in performing the correct action on the wrong object. Obviously, the more the wrong and right objects have in common, the more likely the errors are to occur. Description errors, like all slips, are more likely when we are distracted, bored, involved in other activities, under extra stress, or otherwise not inclined to pay full attention to the task at hand. Description errors occur most frequently when the wrong and right objects are physically near each other. People have reported a number of description errors to me. Two clerks in a department store were both on the telephone to verify credit cards while simultaneously dealing with a customer and filling out a credit card form. One sales clerk had passed in back of the other to reach the charge forms. When this clerk finished preparing the sales slip, she hung up the handset on the wrong telephone, thereby terminating the other clerk's call. A person intended to put the lid on a sugar bowl, but instead put it on a coffee cup, with the same size opening. I had a report of someone who planned to pour orange juice into a glass, but instead poured it into a coffee cup adjacent to the glass. Another person told me of intending to pour rice from a storage jar into a measuring cup, but instead pouring cooking oil into the measuring cup. Both the oil and the rice were kept in glass containers on the counter. Some things seem designed to cause slips. Long rows of identical switches are perfect setups for description errors. Intend to flip one switch, instead flip a similar-looking one. It happens in industrial plants, aircraft, homes, anywhere. When different actions have similar descriptions, there is a good chance of mishap, especially when the operator is experienced and well-practiced and therefore not paying full attention, and if there are more important things to do. Data-driven errors. I was assigning a visitor a room to use. I decided to call the department secretary to tell her the room number. I used the telephone in the alcove outside the room with the room number in sight. Instead of dialing the secretary's phone number, which I use frequently and know very well, I dialed the room number. Much human behavior is automatic. For example, brushing away an insect. Automatic actions are data-driven, triggered by the arrival of the sensory data. But sometimes data-driven activities can intrude into an ongoing action sequence, causing behavior that was not intended. Associative activation errors. My office phone rang. I picked up the receiver and bellowed, "Come in!" at it. If external data can sometimes trigger actions, so too can internal thoughts and associations. The ringing of the telephone and knocking on the door both signal the need to greet someone. Other errors occur from associations among thoughts and ideas. Associative activation errors are the slips studied by Freud. You think something that ought not to be said, and then, to your embarrassment, you say it. Loss of activation errors. I have to go to the bedroom before I start working in the dining room. I start going there and realize, as I am walking, that I have no idea why I am going there. Knowing myself, I keep going, hoping that someone in the bedroom will remind me. I get there but still cannot recall what I wanted. So I go back to the dining room. There I realize that my glasses are dirty. With great relief, I go back to the bedroom, get my handkerchief, and wipe my glasses clean. One of the more common slips is simply forgetting to do something. More interesting is forgetting part of the act, remembering the rest, as in the story above where the goal was forgotten, but the rest of the action continued unimpaired. One of my informants walked all the way through the house to the kitchen and opened the refrigerator door, then wondered why he was there. Lack of activation errors occur because the presumed mechanism, the activation of the goals, has decayed. The less technical but more common term would be forgetting. Mode errors. I had just completed a long run from my university to my home in what I was convinced would be record time. It was dark when I got home, so I could not read the time on my stopwatch. As I walked up and down the street in front of my home, cooling off, I got more and more anxious to see how fast I had run. I then remembered that my watch had a built-in light operated by the upper right-hand button. Elated, I depressed the button to illuminate the reading, only to read a time of 0 seconds. I had forgotten that in stopwatch mode, the same button that in the normal time-reading mode would have turned on a light cleared the time and reset the stopwatch. Mode errors occur when devices have different modes of operation, and the action appropriate for one mode has different meanings in other modes. Mode errors are inevitable any time equipment is designed to have more possible actions than it has controls or displays, so the controls must do double duty. Mode errors are especially likely where the equipment does not make the mode visible, so the user is expected to remember what mode has been established, sometimes for many hours. Mode errors are common with digital watches and computer systems, especially text editors. Several accidents in commercial aviation can be attributed to mode errors, especially in the use of the automatic pilots, which have a large number of complex modes. Detecting slips. Although slips are relatively easy to detect because there is a clear discrepancy between goal and result, detection can only take place if there is feedback. If the result of the action is not visible, how can a misaction be detected? Even when a mismatch is noted, the person may not believe that the error occurred. Some trail of the sequence of actions that was performed is valuable. Even when an error has been detected, it may not be clear what the error was. Alice was driving a van and noticed that the rearview mirror on the passenger side was not adjusted properly. Alice meant to say to the passenger on the right, "Please adjust the mirror," but instead said, "Please adjust the window." The passenger, Sally, was confused and asked, "What should I do? What do you want?" Alice repeated the request, "Adjust the window for me." The situation continued through several frustrating cycles of conversation and attempts by the passenger to understand just what adjustments should be made to the window. The error correction mechanism adopted by the driver was to repeat the erroneous sentence more and more loudly. In this example, it was easy to detect that something was wrong, but hard to discover what. Alice believed the problem was that she couldn't be understood or heard. She was monitoring the wrong part of the action sequence. She had a problem of level. Actions can be specified at many different levels. Suppose I were driving my car to the bank. At any given moment, the action being performed could be described at many different levels. Driving to the bank. Turning into the parking lot. Making a right turn. Rotating the steering wheel clockwise. Moving my left hand upward and to the right and my right hand downward. Increasing the tension on the sternocostal portion of the pectoralis major muscle. All these levels are active at the same time. The most global description, the one at the top of the list, is called the high-level specification. The more detailed descriptions, the ones at the bottom of the list, are called low-level specifications. Any one of them might be an error. It is often possible to detect that the result of an action is not as planned, but then not to know at which level of specification the error has taken place. Problems of level commonly thwart the correction of error. My collection of slips includes several examples in which a person detects a problem, but attempts to correct it at the wrong level. One frequent example is the non-working key, reported to me both for cars and homes. Someone goes to his or her car and the key won't work. The first response is to try again, perhaps holding the key more level or straight. Then the key is reversed, tried upside down. When that fails, the key is examined and perhaps another tried in its stead. Then the door is wiggled, shaken, hit. Finally, the person decides that the lock has broken and walks around the car to try the other door, at which point it is suddenly clear that this is the wrong car. In all the situations I have examined, the error correction mechanism seems to start at the lowest possible level and slowly works its way higher. Whether this is universally true, I do not know, but the hypothesis warrants further examination. Design lessons from the study of slips. Two different kinds of design lessons can be drawn, one for preventing slips before they occur, and one for detecting and correcting them when they do occur. In general, the solutions follow directly from the preceding analyses. For example, mode errors are minimized by minimizing modes, or at least by making modes visible. Cars provide a number of examples of how design relates to error. A variety of fluids are required in the engine compartment of an automobile. Engine oil, transmission oil, brake fluid, windshield washer solution, radiator coolant, battery water. Putting the wrong fluid into a reservoir could lead to serious damage or even an accident. Automobile manufacturers try to minimize these errors, a combination of description and mode errors, by making the different compartments look different, using different shapes and different size openings, and by adding color to the fluids so that they can be distinguished. Here, design, by and large, prevents errors. But unfortunately, designers seem to prefer to encourage them. I was in a taxi in Austin, Texas, admiring the large number of new devices in front of the driver. No more simple radio. In its place was a computer display, so that messages from the dispatcher were now printed on the screen. The driver took great delight in demonstrating all the features to me. On the radio transmitter, I saw four identical-looking buttons laid out in a row. "Oh," I said, "you have four different radio channels." "Nope," he replied, "three. The fourth button resets all the settings. Then it takes me 30 minutes to get everything all set up properly again." "Hmm," I said, "I bet you hit that every now and then by accident." "I certainly do," he replied, in his own unprintable words. In computer systems, it is common to prevent errors by requiring confirmation before a command will be executed, especially when the action will destroy a file. But the request is ill-timed. It comes just after the person has initiated the action and is still fully content with the choice. The standard interaction goes something like this. User: remove file, my most important work. Computer: are you certain you wish to remove the file, my most important work? User: yes. Computer: are you certain? User: yes, of course. Computer: the file, my most important work, has been removed. User: oops, damn. The user has requested deletion of the wrong file, but the computer's request for confirmation is unlikely to catch the error. The user is confirming the action, not the file name. Thus, asking for confirmation cannot catch all slips. It would be more appropriate to eliminate irreversible actions. In this example, the request to remove a file would be handled by the computers moving the file to some temporary holding place. Then the user would have time for reconsideration and recovery. At a research laboratory I once directed, we discovered that people would frequently throw away their records and notes, only to discover the next day that they needed them again. We solved the problem by getting 7 trash cans and labeling them with the days of the week. Then the trash can labeled Wednesday would be used only on Wednesdays. At the end of the day, it was safely stored away and not emptied until the next Tuesday, just before it was to be used again. People discovered that they kept neater records and books because they no longer hesitated to throw away things that they thought would probably never be used again. They figured it was safe to throw something away, for they still had a week in which to change their minds. But design is often a trade-off. We had to make room for the 6 reserve waste baskets, and we had a never-ending struggle with the janitorial staff who kept trying to empty all of the waste baskets every evening. The users of the computer center came to depend upon the soft nature of the waste baskets and would discard things that they otherwise might have kept for a while longer. When there was an error, sometimes on the part of the janitorial staff, sometimes on our part in cycling the waste baskets properly, then it was a calamity. When you build an error-tolerant mechanism, people come to rely upon it, so it had better be reliable. Mistakes as errors of thought. Mistakes result from the choice of inappropriate goals. A person makes a poor decision, misclassifies a situation, or fails to take all the relevant factors into account. Many mistakes arise from the vagaries of human thought, often because people tend to rely upon remembered experiences rather than on more systematic analysis. We make decisions based upon what is in our memory. Memory is biased toward overgeneralization and overregularization of the commonplace, and overemphasis on the discrepant. Some models of human thought. Psychologists have chronicled the failures of thought, the non-rationality of real behavior. Even simple tasks can sometimes throw otherwise clever people into disarray. Even though principles of rationality seem as often violated as followed, we still cling to the notion that human thought should be rational, logical, and orderly. Much of law is based upon the concept of rational thought and behavior. Much of economic theory is based upon the model of the rational human who attempts to optimize personal benefit, utility, or comfort. Many scientists who study artificial intelligence use the mathematics of formal logic, the predicate calculus, as their major tool to simulate thought. But human thought, and its close relatives, problem-solving and planning, seem more rooted in past experience than in logical deduction. Mental life is not neat and orderly. It does not proceed smoothly and gracefully in neat logical form. Instead, it hops, skips, and jumps its way from idea to idea, tying together things that have no business being put together, forming new creative leaps, new insights and concepts. Human thought is not like logic. It is fundamentally different in kind and in spirit. The difference is neither worse nor better, but it is the difference that leads to creative discovery and to great robustness of behavior. Thought and memory are closely related, for thought relies heavily upon the experiences of life. Indeed, much problem-solving and decision-making takes place through attempts to remember some previous experience that can serve as a guide for the present. There have been many theories of human memory. For example, every method of filing things has shown up somewhere along the line as a model for human memory. Do you file photographs neatly in a scrapbook? One theory of memory has postulated that our experiences are neatly encoded and organized as if in a photo album. This theory is wrong. Human memory is most definitely not like a set of photographs or a tape recording. It mushes things together too much, confuses one event with another, combines different events, and leaves out parts of individual events. Another theory is based on the filing cabinet model, wherein there are lots of cross-references and pointers to other records. This theory has a good deal going for it, and it is probably a reasonable characterization of the most prominent approach today. Of course, it is not called a file cabinet theory. It goes by the names of schema theory, frame theory, or sometimes semantic networks and propositional encoding. The individual file folders are defined in the formal structure of the schemas or frames, and the connections and associations among the individual records make the structure into a vast and complex network. The essence of the theory consists of three beliefs, all reasonable and supported by considerable evidence. One, that there is logic and order to the individual structures. This is what the schema or frame is about. Two, that human memory is associative, with each schema pointing and referring to multiple others to which it is related, or that help define the components, thus the term network. And three, that much of our power for deductive thought comes from using the information in one schema to deduce the properties of another, thus the term propositional encoding. To illustrate the third concept, once I learn that all living animals breathe, I know that any live animal I will ever meet will breathe. I don't have to learn this separately for all animals. We call this the default value. Unless told otherwise, anything I learn for a general concept applies to all of its instances by default. Default values do not have to apply to everything. I can learn exceptions, such as that all birds fly except for penguins and ostriches. But defaults hold true unless an exception shows otherwise. Deduction is a most useful and powerful property of human memory. The connectionist approach. We are still a long way from understanding human memory and cognition. Today, in the developing field of cognitive science, two different views are emerging. The traditional view considers thought to be rational, logical, and orderly. This approach uses mathematical logic as the scientific means to explain thought. Adherents of this approach have pioneered the development of schemas as the mechanism of human memory. A newer approach is rooted in the working of the brain itself. Those of us who follow this new approach call it connectionism, but it also goes under the names of neural nets, neural models, and parallel distributed processing. It is an attempt to model the way in which the brain itself is structured, with billions of brain cells connected into groups, many cells connected to tens of thousands of others, many all working at the same time. This approach follows the rules of thermodynamics more than it does the rules of logic. Connectionism is still tentative, still unproven. I believe that it has the potential to explain much of what puzzled us before. But part of the scientific community thinks that it is fundamentally flawed. The brain consists of billions of nerve cells, neurons, each connected to thousands of other cells. Each neuron sends simple signals to the neurons to which it is connected, each signal attempting to increase or decrease the activity of its recipient. The connectionist approach to the study of thought mimics these connections. Each connectionist unit is connected to many other units. The signals are either positive in value, called activation signals, or negative in value, called inhibition. Each unit adds up the total influence of the signals that it receives, and then sends along its outward connections a signal whose value is a function of that sum. That's about all there is to it. The elements are all simple. The complexity and power come from the fact that there are a large number of interconnected units trying to influence the activities of the others. All this interconnection leads to massive interaction among the units, with the signals sometimes leading to fights and conflicts, sometimes to cooperation and stability. After a while, however, the system of interconnected units will eventually settle down to a stable state that represents a compromise among the opposing forces. Thoughts are represented by stable patterns of activity. New thoughts are triggered whenever there is some change in the system, oftentimes because some new information arrives at the senses and changes the pattern of activation and inhibition. We can think of the interactions as the computational part of thought. When one set of units sends signals activating another, this can be interpreted as offering support for a cooperative interpretation of events. When one set of units sends signals suppressing another, it is because the two usually offer competing interpretations. The result of all this support and competition is a compromise. Not the correct interpretation, simply one that is as consistent as possible with all possibilities under active consideration. This approach suggests that much of thought results from a kind of pattern matching system, one that forces its solutions to be analogous to past experiences, and one that does not necessarily follow the formal rules of logical inference. The relaxation of interacting connectionist structures into patterns happens relatively quickly and automatically, below the surface of consciousness. We are conscious only of the end states, not of the means for getting there. As a result, in this view of the mind, our explanations of our own behavior are always suspect, for they amount to stories made up after the fact to explain the thoughts that we already have. Much of our knowledge is hidden beneath the surface of our minds, inaccessible to conscious inspection. We discover our own knowledge primarily through our actions. We can also find out by testing ourselves, by trying to retrieve examples from memory, self-generated examples. Think of an example, Then think of another example. Find a story that explains them. Then we believe that story and call it the reason or explanation for our behavior. The problem is that the story changes dramatically depending upon what examples we select. And the examples we select depend upon a large set of factors, some under our control, some not. The connectionist approach to memory might also be called the multiple exposure theory of memory. Suppose, unbeknownst to you, your camera broke so that the film wouldn't wind. Every picture you took went right on top of all the others. If you had taken pictures of different scenes, you might still be able to make out the individual parts. But suppose you had taken a picture of a high school graduating class, one person at a time. Each person took a turn sitting in the chair in front of the fixed camera. Each smiled. Each had a picture taken. Afterward, when you developed the film, you would find just one picture, a composite of all those faces. All the individual records would still be there, but on top of one another, difficult to separate out. You'd have the average high school graduate. Throw everything into memory on top of one another. That is a crude approximation of the connectionist approach to memory. Actually, things aren't thrown together until after a lot of processing has gone on. And memory isn't really like a multiple exposure. Still, this is not a bad characterization of the connectionist approach. Consider what happens when two similar events are experienced. They merge together to form a kind of average, a prototypical event. This prototype governs interpretations and actions related to any other event that seems similar. What happens when something really discrepant occurs? If it is quite different from the prototype, it still manages to maintain its identity when thrown into memory. It stands out by itself. If there were 1,000 similar events, we would tend to remember them as one composite prototype. If there were just one discrepant event, we would remember it too, for by being discrepant, it didn't get smudged up with the rest. But the resulting memory is almost as if there had been only two events, the common one and the discrepant one. The common one is 1,000 times more likely, but not to the memory. In memory, there are only two things, and the discrepant event hardly seems less likely than the everyday one. So it is with human memory. We mush together details of things that are similar and give undue weight to the discrepant. We relish discrepant and unusual memories. We remember them, talk about them, and bias behavior toward them in wholly inappropriate ways. What has this to do with everyday thought? A lot. Everyday thought seems to be based upon past experiences, upon our ability to retrieve an event from the past and use it to model the present. This event-based reasoning is powerful, yet fundamentally flawed. Because thought is based on what can be recalled, the rare event can predominate. Think about it. Think of your experiences with computers, or VCRs, or home appliances. What probably come to mind are the unusual experiences, things that are discrepant. It doesn't matter that you may have used the device 100 times successfully. It is the one time you got embarrassed that will come to mind. The limitations of human thought processes have important implications for everyday activities, and in fact can be called in to distinguish everyday activities from others. The structure of tasks. Everyday activities are conceptually simple. We should be able to do most things without having to think about what we're doing. The simplicity lies in the nature of the structure of tasks. Wide and deep structures. Consider the game of chess, an activity that is neither everyday nor simple, at least not for most of us. When it is my turn to play, I have a number of possible moves. For each of my moves, my opponent has a number of possible responses. And for each of my opponent's responses, I have a number of possible counter-responses. The sequences can be represented on a decision tree, a diagram that in this case takes the current board position as a starting point, and shows each of my possible moves, each of the possible counter-moves, each possible counter-counter-move, each possible counter-counter-counter-move, and so on, as deep as time and energy permit. The size of the tree for chess is immense, for the number of choices increases exponentially. Suppose that at each spot there are 8 possible moves. At that spot, I must consider 8 initial moves for me. 8 times 8 equals 64 replies of my opponent. 64 times 8 equals 512 replies I can make. 512 times 8 equals 4,096 possible replies by my opponent. And then 4,096 times 8 equals 32,768 more possibilities for me. As you can see, the decision tree gets large rapidly. Looking ahead 5 moves means considering over 30,000 possibilities. The tree is characterized by a vast spreading network of possibilities. There isn't space here for the decision tree for chess, but even a simple game like tic-tac-toe or noughts and crosses has a similar structure, shown in Figure 21. That decision tree for chess is even wider and deeper. Wide in the sense that at each point in the tree there are many alternatives, so that the tree spreads out over a considerable area. Deep in the sense that most branches of the tree go on for a considerable distance. Everyday activities don't require the kind of complex analyses required for something like chess. In most everyday activities, we need only examine the alternatives and act. Everyday structures are either shallow or narrow. Shallow structures. The menu of an ice cream store provides a good example of a shallow structure. There are many alternative actions, but each is simple. There are few decisions to make after the single top-level choice. The major problem is to decide which action to do. Difficulties arise from competing alternatives, not from any prolonged search, problem-solving, or trial and error. In shallow structures, there's no problem of planning or depth of analysis. Narrow structures. A cookbook recipe is a good example of a narrow structure. A narrow structure arises when there are only a small number of alternatives, perhaps 1 or 2. If each possibility leads to only 1 or 2 further choices, then the resulting tree structure can be said to be narrow and deep. Just as the ice cream store menu is an example of a shallow structure, the multi-course fixed menu meal can serve as an example of a deep structure. Although there may be many courses, for each course, the diner is either automatically served the relevant dish or offered the choice of 1 or 2 dishes. The only action required is to accept one or to refuse. No deep thought is required. Another example is the sequence of steps required to start a car. You must go to the car, select the proper key, insert it in the door lock, turn the key, open the door, remove the key. Get into the car, close the door, put on the seatbelt, insert the proper key into the ignition, make sure the car is not in gear, start the engine, and so on. This is a deep structure, but it is narrow. There is a long series of steps, but at each point there are few, if any, alternatives to consider. Any task that involves a sequence of activities, where the action to be done at any point is determined by its place in the sequence, is an example of a narrow structure. The modern superhighway offers the driver a series of exits. The driver either starts on the road with a predetermined exit in mind, or else must decide at each exit whether to stay on the road or not. In fact, road designers attempt to linearize and simplify the decision-making tasks of the driver. The relevant information is fed slowly and sequentially to the driver to minimize the mental workload and the need for overlapping processing. Freeway design is by now a science, with a well-defined set of procedures and with societies, books, and journals devoted to it. Different countries of the world have reached different solutions to the problem of guiding the driver. A rather complete analysis was done in Britain for the design of the M-series motorways. Each motorway exit has a carefully programmed sequence of 6 signs. The first precedes the exit by 1 mile, and is intended to serve as an alerting function, as well as to present route number information. The second precedes the exit by 1/2 mile, and gives the major towns reached by the exit, but no route number information. The third precedes the exit by 1/4 mile and adds the forward destination, where you eventually get to if you don't exit. The fourth sign is at the exit and provides major route numbers and a few town names. The fifth sign is on the motorway beyond the exit. It is intended to play a confirmatory role. It displays the forward destinations and their distances. The sixth sign is on the exit ramp. In colors, the reverse of all the preceding signs. It shows all the local destinations, usually on a map of the roundabout, traffic circle, found at most exits. The nature of everyday tasks. Most tasks of daily life are routine, requiring little thought or planning. Things like bathing and dressing, brushing teeth, eating at the table, getting to work, meeting with friends, going to the theater. These are the daily activities that occupy most of our time, and there are many of them. Yet each by itself is relatively simple, either shallow or narrow. What are not everyday activities? Those with wide and deep structures, the ones that require considerable conscious planning and thought, deliberate trial and error, trying first this approach, then that, backtracking. Unusual tasks include writing a long document or letter, making a major or complex purchase, computing income tax, planning a special meal, arranging a vacation trip. And don't forget intellectual games. Bridge, chess, poker, crossword puzzles, and so on. The tasks most frequently studied by psychologists are not everyday tasks. They are things like chess or algebraic puzzles, which require much thought and effort. But indeed, these pursuits have just the sort of wide and deep structures that do not characterize everyday activities. In general, we find wide and deep structures in games and leisure activities, where the structure is devised so as to occupy the mind or to make the task deliberately and artificially difficult. After all, what challenge would there be if games such as chess or bridge were conceptually simple? How would interest in a mystery novel, or any novel for that matter, be sustained if the plot were straightforward and the answers readily deducible? Recreational activities should be wide and deep, for we do them when we have the time and wish to expend the effort. In the everyday world, we want to get on with the important things of life, not spend our time in deep thought, attempting to open a can of food or dial a telephone number. Everyday activities must usually be done relatively quickly, often simultaneously with other activities. Neither time nor mental resources may be available. As a result, everyday activities structure themselves so as to minimize conscious mental activity, which means they must minimize planning, and especially any planning with extensive looking ahead and backing up, and mental computation. These characteristics restrict everyday tasks to those that are shallow, having no need for extensive looking ahead and backing up, and those that are narrow, having few choices at any point, and therefore requiring little planning. If the structure is shallow, width is not important. If the structure is narrow, depth is not important. In either case, the mental effort required for doing the task is minimized. Conscious and subconscious behavior. Much human behavior is done subconsciously, without conscious awareness and not available to inspection. The exact relationship between conscious and subconscious thought is still under great debate. The resulting scientific puzzles are complex and not easily solved. Subconscious thought matches patterns. It operates, I believe, by finding the best possible match of one's past experience to the current one. It proceeds rapidly and automatically without effort. Subconscious processing is one of our strengths. It is good at detecting general trends, at recognizing the relationship between what we now experience and what has happened in the past. And it is good at generalizing, at making predictions about the general trend based on few examples. But subconscious thought can find matches that are inappropriate or wrong, and it may not distinguish the common from the rare. Subconscious thought is biased toward regularity and structure, and it is limited in formal power. It may not be capable of symbolic manipulation, of careful reasoning through a sequence of steps. Conscious thought is quite different. It is slow and labored. Here is where we slowly ponder decisions, think through alternatives, compare different choices. Conscious thought ponders first this approach, then that, comparing, rationalizing, finding explanations. Formal logic, mathematics, decision theory, these are the tools of conscious thought. Both conscious and subconscious modes of thought are powerful and essential aspects of human life. Both can provide insightful leaps and creative moments, and both are subject to errors, misconceptions, and failures. Conscious thought tends to be slow and serial. Conscious processing seems to involve short-term memory and is thereby limited in the amount that can be readily available. Try consciously to solve the children's game called tic-tac-toe, or noughts and crosses, and you will discover that you can't. Not if you try to explore all the alternatives. How can I claim that a trivial children's game cannot be done in the head? Because you don't really play the game by thinking it through. You play by memorizing the patterns, by transforming the game into something simpler. Try playing the following game. Start with the 9 numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. You and your opponent alternate turns, each time taking a number. Each number can be taken only once, so if your opponent has selected a number, you cannot also take it. The first person to have any 3 numbers that total 15 wins the game. This is a difficult game. You will find it is very hard to play without writing it down. But this game is identical to tic-tac-toe. Why should it be hard if tic-tac-toe is easy? To see the relationship between the game of 15 and tic-tac-toe, simply arrange the 9 digits into a square pattern, 3 rows one on top of another. Going from the left to right, the digits in the first row are 8, 1, and 6. In the second row, 3, 5, and 7. And in the third row, 4, 9, and 2. Now you can see the connection. Any 3 numbers that solve the 15 problem also solve tic-tac-toe. And any tic-tac-toe solution is also a solution to 15. So why is one easy and the other hard? Because tic-tac-toe takes advantage of perceptual abilities, and because you simplify tic-tac-toe by changing it in several ways, by taking advantage of symmetries, and by memorizing, learning, the basic opening moves and their appropriate responses. In the end, unless someone makes a slip, 2 players will always draw, neither one winning. The transformations of tic-tac-toe have made a complex task into an everyday one. The everyday version doesn't require much mental effort. It does not require planning and thinking, and it is boring. Which is exactly what everyday tasks ought to be. Boring. So that we can put our conscious attention on the important things of life, not the routine. Conscious thought is severely limited by the small capacity of short-term memory. 5 or 6 items is all that can be kept available at any one moment. But subconscious thought is one of the tools of the conscious mind, and the memory limitation can be overcome if only an appropriate organizational structure can be found. Take 15 unrelated things, and it is not possible to keep them in conscious memory at once. Organize them into a structure, and it is easy, for only that one structure has to be kept in conscious memory. As a result of this power of organization to overcome the limits of working memory, explanation and understanding become essential components of conscious thought. With understanding and explanation, the number of things that can be kept consciously in mind expands enormously. Now consider how mistakes might be made. By mismatch, by taking the current situation and falsely matching it with something in the past. Although we are really good at finding examples from the past to match the present, these examples are biased in one of 2 ways. Toward the regularities of the past, the prototypical situation, or toward the unique discrepant event. But suppose the current event is different from all that has been experienced before. It is neither common nor unique. It is simply rare. We won't deal well with it. We are apt to classify the rare with either the common or the unique, and either of these choices is wrong. The same powers that make us so good at dealing with the common and the unique lead to severe errors with the rare. Explaining away errors. A reformed thief, telling of his success, put it this way. I'm telling you, If I had $100 for every time I heard a dog owner tell their dog to shut up, go lie down, while I was right outside their window, I'd be a millionaire. Mistakes, especially when they involve misinterpreting the situation, can take a very long time to be discovered. For one thing, the interpretation is quite reasonable at the time. This is a special problem in a novel situation. The situation may look very much like others we've been in. We tend to confuse the rare event with the frequent one. How many times have you heard a strange noise while driving your car, only to dismiss it as not relevant or unimportant? How many times does your dog bark in the night, causing you to get up and yell out, "Be quiet!" And what if the car turns out to be broken, and your mistake has increased the damage? Or there really is a burglar outside, but you've silenced the dog. This problem is natural. There are lots of things we could pay attention to or worry about. Most would be false alarms, irrelevant minor events. At the other extreme, we can ignore everything, rationally explain each apparent anomaly. Hear a noise that sounds like a pistol shot and explain it away. Must be a car's exhaust backfiring. Hear someone yell out and think, "Why can't my neighbors be quiet?" Most of the time we are correct, but when we are not, our explanation seems stupid and hard to justify. When there is a devastating accident, people's explaining away the signs of the impending disaster always seems implausible to others. Afterward, there is a tendency to read about what has taken place and to criticize. How could those people be so stupid? Fire them. Pass a law against it. Redo the training. Look at the nuclear power accidents. Operators at Three Mile Island made numerous errors and misdiagnoses, but each one was logical and understandable at the time. The nuclear plant disaster at Chernobyl in the Soviet Union was triggered by a well-intentioned attempt to test the safety features of the plant. The action seemed logical and sensible to the operators at the time, but now their judgments can be seen to have been erroneous. Explaining away errors is a common problem in commercial accidents. Most major accidents follow a series of breakdowns and errors, problem after problem, each making the next more likely. Seldom does a major accident occur without numerous failures, equipment malfunctions, unusual events, a series of apparently unrelated breakdowns and errors that culminate in major disaster. Yet no single step has appeared to be serious. In many of these cases, the people involved noted the problem but explained it away, finding a logical explanation for the otherwise deviant observation. The contrast in our understanding before and after an event can be dramatic. The psychologist Baruch Fischhoff has studied explanations given in hindsight, where events seem completely obvious and predictable after the fact, but completely unpredictable beforehand. Fischhoff presented people with a number of situations and asked them to predict what would happen. They were correct only at the chance level. He then presented the same situation along with the actual outcome to another group of people, asking them to state how likely the outcome was. When the actual outcome was known, it appeared to be plausible and likely, whereas the others appeared unlikely. When the actual outcome was not known, the various alternatives had quite different plausibility. It is a lot easier to determine what is obvious after it has happened. Social pressures and mistakes. A subtle issue that seems to figure in many accidents is social pressure. Although it may not at first seem to be relevant in design, it has strong influence on everyday behavior. In industrial settings, social pressure can lead to misinterpretation, mistakes, and accidents. For understanding mistakes, social structure is every bit as essential as physical structure. Look at airline accidents. Not everyday activities for most of us, but subject to the same principles. In 1983, Korean Air Flight 007 strayed over the Soviet Union and got shot down, probably because of an error in programming the flight path into the Inertial Navigation System, INS. Although each checkpoint was discrepant, apparently the deviations were easily explained away. If the crew substituted for each point the checkpoint reading for the previous INS point. But there were significant social pressures operating as well. The crew of Flight 007 probably misprogrammed the INS, but the INS couldn't be reprogrammed in flight. If an error were detected, the aircraft would have to go back to the original airport, land, jettisoning fuel to get to a safe landing weight, and then reset the INS and take off again. An expensive proposition. Three Korean air flights had returned to their airport in the 6 months preceding the Flight 007 incident, and the airline had told its pilots that the next pilot who returned would be punished. Was this a factor in the accident? It's hard to know. But the design of the INS sounds badly deficient. The social pressures on the crew not to find or admit to an error in the INS were clearly strong. But punishment for following a safety procedure is never wise. The proper approach would be to redesign either the INSs or the procedures for using them. The real culprit, almost always, is the design. Design that makes it easy to make wrong settings, or to misread an instrument, or to misclassify an event. Design of the social structure that makes false reporting of danger punishable. Turn a nuclear power plant off by mistake, and you cost the company hundreds of thousands of dollars. You'll probably lose your job. Fail to turn it off when there is a real incident, and you might lose your life. If you refuse to fly a crowded airliner because the weather looks bad, the company loses lots of money and the passengers get very angry. Take off under those situations, and most of the time it works out fine, which encourages risk-taking. But every so often there is a disaster. Tenerife, the Canary Islands, in 1977. A KLM Boeing 747 that was taking off crashed into a Pan American 747 that was taxiing on the runway, killing 583 people. The KLM plane should not have tried to take off then, but the weather was starting to get bad, and the crew had already been delayed for too long. Even being on the Canary Islands was a diversion from the scheduled flight. They had to land there because bad weather had prevented them from landing at their scheduled destination. They had not received clearance to take off, and the Pan American flight should not have been on the runway, but there was considerable misunderstanding between the pilots and the air traffic controllers. Furthermore, the fog was coming in, so neither plane could see the other. There were time pressures and economic pressures acting together. The Pan American pilots questioned their orders to taxi on the runway, but they continued anyway. The co-pilot of the KLM flight voiced minor objections to the pilot, suggesting that they were not yet cleared for takeoff. All in all, a tragedy occurred due to a complex mixture of social pressures and logical explaining away of discrepant observations. The Air Florida flight from National Airport, Washington, D.C., crashed at takeoff into the 14th Street Bridge over the Potomac River, killing 78 people, including four who were on the bridge. The plane should not have taken off because there was ice on the wings, but it had already been delayed over an hour and a half. This and other factors may have predisposed the crew to hurry. The accident occurred despite the first officer's, the co-pilot's, concern. Although the first officer expressed concern that something was not right to the captain four times during the takeoff, the captain took no action to reject the takeoff. Again, we see social pressures, coupled with time and economic forces. Designing for error. Error is often thought of as something to be avoided, or something done by unskilled or unmotivated people. But everyone makes errors. Designers make the mistake of not taking error into account. Inadvertently, they can make it easy to err and difficult or impossible to discover error, or to recover from it. Consider the London stock market story that opened this chapter. The system was poorly designed. It should not be possible for one person, with one simple error, to cause such widespread damage. Here is what designers should do. 1. Understand the causes of error and design to minimize those causes. 2. Make it possible to reverse actions, to undo them, or make it harder to do what cannot be reversed. 3. Make it easier to discover the errors that do occur and make them easier to correct. 4. Change the attitude toward errors. Think of an object's user as attempting to do a task, getting there by imperfect approximations. Don't think of the user as making errors. Think of the actions as approximations of what is desired. When someone makes an error, there usually is good reason for it, If it was a mistake, the information available was probably incomplete or misleading. The decision was probably sensible at the time. If it was a slip, it was probably due to poor design or distraction. Errors are usually understandable and logical once you think through their causes. Don't punish the person for making errors. Don't take offense. But most of all, don't ignore it. Try to design the system to allow for errors. Realize that normal behavior isn't always accurate. Design so that errors are easy to discover and corrections are possible. How to deal with error and how not to. Consider the error of locking your keys into your car. Some cars have made this error much less likely. You simply can't lock the doors, not easily anyway, except by using the key. So you're pretty much forced to have the keys with you. I call this kind of design a forcing function. More on this topic in the next section. In the United States, cars are required to be designed so that if the door is opened while the keys are in the ignition, a warning sound comes on. In theory, if you walk away from your car, leaving the keys in the ignition, the buzzer will call you back. Yet the signal must be ignored as often as it must be attended to. It must be ignored when you open the door of your car while the engine is running, so you can hand someone something. On these occasions, it is annoying. You know the door is open, and sometimes you want to or need to leave the keys in the car. There goes the buzzer. It can't distinguish deliberate actions from erroneous ones. Warning signals are usually not the answer. Consider the control room of a nuclear power plant, or the cockpit of a commercial aircraft. Thousands of instruments, each designed by someone who thought it was necessary to put in a warning signal for it. Many of the signals sound the same. Most can be ignored anyway because they tell the operator about something that is already known. And when a real emergency happens, all the warning signals seem to go on at once. Each competes with the others to be heard, preventing the person from concentrating upon the problem. Built-in warning features are bypassed for several reasons. One is that they can go off in error, disrupting perfectly sensible proper behavior. Another is that they often conflict, and the resulting cacophony is distracting enough to hamper performance. Finally, they are often inconvenient. You can't sit in the car on a warm day, open the door to get some air, and listen to the radio. The key must be in the ignition to make the radio work, but then the door buzzes all the time. So we disconnect those warning signals, tape them over, silence the bell, unscrew the light bulbs. Warnings and safety methods must be used with care and intelligence, taking into account the trade-offs for the people who are affected. Forcing functions. Forcing functions are a form of physical constraint, situations in which the actions are constrained so that failure at one stage prevents the next step from happening. Starting a car has a forcing function associated with it. You must put the ignition key into the ignition switch. Some time ago, the button that activated the starter motor was separate from the ignition key, so that it was possible to attempt to start the car without the keys. The error was made frequently. In most modern automobiles, the starter switch is activated by turning the key, an effective forcing function that makes you use the key to do the operation. There is no analogous forcing function for removing the key upon leaving the automobile. As we have already seen, those automobiles that have door locks that can be operated only by a key, from outside the vehicle, do introduce a forcing function. If you want to lock the door, you can't leave the key in the car. If a forcing function is really desired, it is usually possible to find one, although at some cost for normal behavior. It is important to think through the implications of that cost, to decide whether people will deliberately disable the forcing function. The history of seatbelts in autos provides a good example. Despite all the evidence that seatbelts are an effective means of saving lives, some people dislike them enough that they refuse to wear them, probably because the perceived risk is so much less than the actual statistical risk. For a short period, the United States tried a forcing function on seatbelts. A special interlock was installed on each new car. If the driver's and passenger's belts were not fastened, the car would not start and a buzzer would sound. This forcing function was so disliked that most drivers had their mechanics disconnected. The law was quickly changed. There seemed to be three problems. First, many people did not want to wear seatbelts, and they resented the mechanical forcing function. Second, The forcing function couldn't distinguish legitimate cases, in which the seatbelt should not be buckled, from illegitimate ones.